pages 45 and 46, to this whole question of, is the New Testament mythology? And I offer here seven reasons why this whole view that the New Testament contains myths is itself a myth. The claim that the New Testament miracles are myths, not history, is refuted, in fact, by numerous lines of evidence. First of all, it's based on anti-supernatural presuppositions of Bultmann, which we've just examined, and when you strip that all away, it defrocks the whole view of its credibility. Before there was anti-supernaturalism, people weren't saying this. It was because of anti-supernaturalism they came up with a demythology view. Most objections to its historicity involve a lack of belief in the credibility of miraculous accounts, which simply means if it weren't for the fact that there are miracles in those stories, no one would be doubting, no serious scholars would be doubting they were authentic. So if it's miracle stories in the record that gain its lack of credibility, then if miracles are credible, then the rest of the record should be accepted as credible, the whole record, including the miracles. So again, it's the anti-supernatural that leads to the belief that there's no credibility there. Once you refute that, you destroy the whole grounds for the mythology view. Secondly, basic books in the New Testament were written by contemporaries and eyewitnesses of the events, Luke 1:1 through 4. It was not the result of later legendary development. The other book written by Dr. Luke, the Acts of the Apostles, was written by a contemporary of the events and has been confirmed by numerous lines of evidence. And I want to refer you to just a super book that's come out in recent years. It's by Hemmer. They're called The Authenticity of the Acts of the Apostles. The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenic History is the actual title. If you look on second page under sources there, Colin J. Hemmer. He is a noted Roman historian. He's not a New Testament scholar. He's a noted Roman historian. And Roman historians have long been in favor of and have defended the authenticity of the Book of Acts. Look down the list there to one called Sherwin White, A.N. Sherwin White, Roman Society and Roman Law in the New Testament. That's another Roman historian who has vouched for the historicity of the Book of Acts. And of course, anyone familiar with the field knows that Sir William Ramsay, whose name is not on this list, wrote a number of books, St. Paul, Traveler, and Roman Citizen, after 20 years of research in the area, in which he showed that the Book of Acts is accurate in every single thing that he could check, which was dozens and dozens of things, cities and names and places and which way the wind blew. But I have never seen anything more comprehensive and more detailed than Hemmer's book. And I just read it about a month ago myself, and it totally destroys any illusion about the Book of Acts not being historical. And in the book, he argues that not only can you prove down to minutiae, down to little tiny details, dozens and dozens of them, that Acts is credible, but that Acts must have been written between 60 and 62 AD. And since there's no question that the same person who wrote Acts wrote Luke, referring to his former letter, O Theophilus, same style, same kind of hard, difficult Greek, that means that the book of Luke had to be written by or before 60 AD. Now, if the book of Luke, which is basically the same story as Matthew and Mark on all the essentials, was written by 60 AD, and you have a book written within 27 years of the events by somebody who was contemporary of the eyewitnesses, and that's the most credible kind of history you can get. There's no time for mythology to develop, as we'll see later. In 27 years, while the eyewitnesses are still alive, there's not a single case in the history of mankind where a myth, a total myth, has evolved in 27 years from the original event while the eyewitnesses were still around. Just has not happened. So so this, I think, is one of the strongest evidences for the historicity. Noted Roman historian Colin Hemmer dates it 60 to 62, which places Luke within about 30 years of the time of the events. Even liberal New Testament critic Bishop John Robinson dated crucial New Testament books as early as 40 to 60 A.D. 40 to 60, that's earlier than evangelicals hold. Now here you got a radical liberal scholar who started the Death of God movement. He's the one who wrote Honest to God, and then he became honest to the facts and wrote Redating the New Testament. And in that book, Redating the New Testament by Bishop Robinson, also on the bibliography there, he argues that John could be as early as 40 or 50 A.D. Now, 40 is 7 years after the events. You show me any book from the ancient world, any book from the ancient world about any major figure where a contemporary wrote the story. Do you know how many years there are between the time that Alexander the Great did his exploits and the first book on Alexander the Great, the life of Alexander, came out? Hundreds of years. Hundreds of years. We just don't have contemporary eyewitness accounts of these great figures from the ancient world, but in the case of the New Testament, we know we have manuscripts and records of books that were written by eyewitnesses who were contemporaries of the events. That's authenticity number one before you even get to, has it been confirmed by archaeology? In the case of Luke, it's been confirmed, that is the book of Acts, more than any other book in the New Testament, maybe any book in the Bible, because we just have dozens and dozens of archaeological finds that directly support minutiae in the book itself. Third, the surrounding persons, places, and events of those narrated in the Gospels were all historical. Luke goes to great pains to note that it was in the days of Caesar Augustus that Jesus was born, and later baptized in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being the governor of Judea, Herod being the tetrarch of Galilee, Annas and Caiaphas being high priests. Now, if that doesn't have the ring of authenticity, you tell me what it was. Look at all the details he gives there about actual persons. We know all of them lived. We know that they lived at this time. We know that their titles were accurate down to the detail. Fourth, there is no time or way for a legend to develop while the eyewitnesses were still alive to refute the story. A legend takes time and or remoteness to develop, neither of which were available here. Noted Roman historian Sherwin White calls the mythological view of the New Testament unbelievable. And here we have New Testament scholars saying that the New Testament is a myth. Secular Roman historians say it's history. We have almost the same thing in Genesis. We got an agnostic astronomer, Robert Jastrow, saying Genesis is literally true, that the universe came into existence out of nothing and there was a big flash of light. Then we have liberal Old Testament scholars saying it's myth. Now when the agnostics say it's literal and liberals say it's a myth, you can see how out of touch with reality the liberal is. The same thing here in the New Testament. Here's what Sherwin White says. The test shows that, first of all, others have noted that the writings of Herodotus enable us to determine the rate at which legends develop. The test shows that even two generations is too short to allow legendary tendencies to wipe out the hard core of historical fact. And I'm citing him there through William Craig, who wrote a book, The Sun Rises. He has two doctor's degrees, one under Pannenberg and one under John Hick. He's a former student of mine from Trinity, who's a brilliant young evangelical apologist who debates atheists all over the country and world and has written a number of good books on this topic. And Craig is quoting him here. The Herodotus example shows that it takes two full generations, that's a generation of at least 30 years, before a myth can develop. You have to have those people dead and out of the way. Julius Mueller challenged the scholars of his day to produce even one example where in one generation a myth developed where the most prominent elements are myths. None were ever found. Nobody has ever found an example where you can do it in less than two full generations. You don't have two full generations between the known time the record's in, 33 AD, and the known time that the first books exist, beyond question, because even liberal scholars accept two things. The Book of Acts being written from around 60 to 62, and 1 Corinthians being written 55 or 60. Now, 1 Corinthians says the essential of Christianity is the death and resurrection of Christ, 1 Corinthians 15, that without which not, the sine qua non. Now, if the death and resurrection of Christ were the essential message of Christianity, which Paul says was handed down to us, handed down, that means it was held by people before that, between 33 and 55, you don't have to be a genius to subtract. You had 22 years. 22 years, less than a generation, for the essential facts, so we know the resurrection wasn't a myth. And if the resurrection isn't a myth, then why should anything else? Why should all the other little miracles in the gospel be a myth? Once you admit the big miracle, then you've admitted the miraculous, and you've admitted the confirmation of Christ's deity in the gospel, so you have eliminated the myth view. Now, to say that a hypothetical gospel Q, non-existent book, secret sayings of Jesus, and other apocryphal books from the second century tell us more than books that were written 22 to 30 years while the eyewitnesses were still alive is just simply to ignore the evidence and spin out your theories in spite of them. Fifth, the New Testament records do not show any signs of being mythological. One great 20th century myth writer himself noted that the straightforward, unembellished record of the New Testament is deprived of any signs of mythology. C.S. Lewis, I'm referring to, said, "I was by now too experienced in literary criticism to regard the Gospels as myths. They had not the mythical taste. And yet the very matter which they set down in their artless historical fashion, those narrow, unattractive Jews, too blind to the mythical wealth of the pagan world around them, was precisely the matter of the great myths, and nothing else in all literature was just like this, and no person was like the person it depicted, as real, as recognizable, through all the depth of time, as Plato's Socrates or Boswell's Johnson." C.S. Lewis, on page 237 of his book on Christian reflections, or rather his book on number one, on miracles. C.S. Lewis is a good example here, because what does it take to recognize a myth? Somebody who spends his life studying myths, because he knows what one is like, he knows the characteristics, he knows the literary form of a myth, he knows the once upon a time type phrases that introduce myths as opposed to the historical. He knows that you don't say during the 15th year of Tiberius under Caesar and Pontius Pilate, you don't say things like that, because then people can trace it back and find out whether indeed it did happen. You just say once upon a time type stuff. So Lewis, and by the way, that was in a message that Lewis gave. Look at his next quote here. "And I'm prepared to say that on that basis, if anyone thinks the Gospels are either legends or novels, that person is simply showing his incompetence as a literary critic." So much for almost all New Testament critics. "I have read a great many novels, and I know a fair amount about legends that grew up among early people, and I know perfectly well the Gospels are not that kind of stuff." End quote. That from one of the greatest literary myth critics of the 20th century. Sixth, no Greek myth spoke of the literal incarnation of a monotheistic God into human form. John 1:1 through 14. by way of a literal virgin birth, nor followed by a death and physical resurrection. The Greeks believed in reincarnation into another mortal body, not resurrection into the same body made immortal. They were polytheists, not monotheists. Now here I'm citing from Yamauchi, down on the list there, Eastern Myth, Hallucination, or History, two-part article in Christianity Today a number of years ago. Yamauchi is a historian at Miami of Ohio. He's a Christian, evangelical Christian, and what he showed in those articles was basically two things. One, that the New Testament could not be myth when it talked about God, the monotheistic God, becoming incarnate, dying and rising from the dead, because no Greek ever believed that, because they didn't believe in monotheism, number one. They believed in polytheism, and they didn't believe in resurrection. They believed in reincarnation. And there's a world of difference between monotheism and polytheism. To say a polytheistic God became incarnate is one thing. To say the monotheistic God became incarnate is another thing. To say the polytheistic God became incarnate temporarily is one thing. To say the monotheistic God became permanently incarnate is another thing. And thirdly, to say that the monotheistic God became incarnate, died, and rose from the dead in the same physical body that he retained thereafter forever is one thing. And to say that a polytheistic God became temporarily incarnate in a human body and then became reincarnate in another mortal body is a totally other view that is worlds apart from what the New Testament said. Now, anybody who can say that Christianity, therefore, is copying pagan myths doesn't understand what the New Testament is teaching and the great gulf between it and what these pagan myths were. Secondly, Yamauchi showed that the pagan myths about God's coming and then coming back and being reincarnate came after the time of Christ, not before. And that's a point missed, because the Golden Bough by Fraser, the book used, written around the turn of the century to support this. By the way, that book was written around 1900. The book is almost 100 years old. You talk about myths. That book by Fraser, The Golden Bough, which is the basis for this myth view, is itself one of the great myths of all time, because it doesn't prove the point. And secondly, the cart is before the horse. The incarnation of Christ happened first, then these pagan myths grew up that their gods came and died and were reincarnate, and that's their simulation. Their attempt to counterfeit, their attempt to counteract Christianity is not that Christianity borrowed from them. They borrowed from the Christian concept and gave their own pagan version. So they got the historical cart is totally on the wrong side of the horse. Seventh, the stories of God, well, this is the point I just made. The stories of God became human via miraculous events like the virgin birth were not prior to. That's really a separate point there. Conclusion. The New Testament record shows no signs of mythological development. Indeed, the miracle events are surrounded by historical references to real people, places, and times. The New Testament documents and witnesses are too early, too numerous, and too accurate to be charged with writing myths. Only an unjustified anti-supernatural bias is grounds for any conclusion to the contrary. So much for the myth hypothesis and the demythology.
The legend of Semiramis and Tammuz, the Tammuz being deity in the form of a man, it's been argued, well, it's been put forth, not really argued, but put forth that this was prior to our concept of a virgin birth of Christ.
Yamauchi replies by saying, The gods and the events supposedly existed before the time of Christ, but the stories didn't exist until after the time of Christ.
Oh, okay.
There's a big difference between saying these gods lived BC And the stories about these gods supposedly doing that being BC, the stories are AD. The stories are after. That smacks of the influence is going the other way.
You certainly have documentation for that.
Yeah. Yamauchi is a sharp scholar. He's a very careful historian. He's a Japanese-American and a very credible historian, teaches at a secular university.
You make reference here to other miraculous events. Is that including like a flood and things of that nature? Aren't those, do not some of those predate the Bible?
See, I'm missing the context of the question because here I'm only talking about the New Testament.
Okay.
And mythology in this particular article. Last night we mentioned that I don't think the flood is a miracle, so it wouldn't fall into that category. But it is true that there are flood stories all over the world and that many people think those are myth. I think they have a kernel of historical truth in them, that there was a flood, and the universality of the story seems to verify the universality of the event in those cases.
Some people say that the first two chapters of Luke weren't in the earliest manuscripts. Do you have any thought about that?
Well, there are some people who say almost anything and almost everything, but nobody ever found, of the 5,366 manuscripts of the New Testament, probably 3,000 of them are manuscripts of the Gospels. The book of Revelation, for example, only has about 200 manuscripts. That's the least any book in the Bible, and the Gospels have probably 3,000 because they were lectionaries and they were used for readings in the churches, and so more of those survived. There's not a single manuscript that gives any evidence to that. That is strictly made out of whole cloth, created out of whole cloth out of the blue.
In other words, the earliest manuscripts do contain the first.
The earliest manuscripts that we have do contain, and if they don't contain, it's because they're mutilated, not because it wasn't there. In other words, we have parts of Gospels and various manuscripts, but of those, I would guess if there are, and there are approximately 3,000 manuscripts of the Gospels, some of those are whole manuscripts, but most of those are part manuscripts. So the ones that are part obviously don't have the whole of every book in which they're part. But there is no manuscript ever found where Luke begins in chapter 3. And there's no manuscript found except mutilated manuscripts of the Gospels where parts are missing out of the middle of a book or end of another book or something like the end of Mark. There's no Gospel found without the chapters, the first two chapters of Luke, or indication that that whole section with others is just mutilated from the manuscript. There's none that begin with something like Luke 3:1, you know, and that just clearly cut between. And I would bet anything, I don't know for sure, but I bet everything that there's probably no manuscript where it simply begins in a way a book begins with chapter 3:1. Any other thoughts, questions on Luke? And if there were one or two that were mutilated like that, there are plenty of others that have all of Luke, including the first two chapters. Hundreds of them. Okay, I want to turn our attention now to redaction criticism, and particularly its influence on evangelicals today. Because unfortunately, a lot of these forms of biblical criticism have infiltrated evangelical circles, and so we have to not only answer the redactionist, but we have to answer a lot of the evangelicals as well. One of the ways that influenced the New Testament evangelical community, or the present evangelical community, is through what's called the redaction canon theory. And the redaction canon theory was proposed by Bruce Waltke, who used to teach at Dallas Seminary and now teaches at Regents, and he taught at Westminster. Here's how the view goes. Basically, it says we don't believe in naturalistic redaction, we believe in supernaturalistic redaction. You throw God in there and it makes it okay, apparently. And we'll see that that's not the case. They argue that inspired redactors made substantial changes in the writings of earlier biblical authors. Now that throws a new factor in the mix. You've got Moses writing, and then after him, inspired redactors come along and they make some changes on what Moses said. Then they write some stuff, and a little later, some inspired redactors do that to Joshua and Samuel and others. So you can't say that what we say against the liberals, that these are falsehoods and these redactions are changing truth. These redactions are inspired of God. So you got inspired redactors doing the thing. And here are the arguments that they give. Someone after Moses, possibly Joshua, wrote the last chapter of Deuteronomy. After all, how can Moses write the chapter on his own death, since it's not prophetic and it records Moses' death? Two, certain sections of Deuteronomy, like chapter 2 there, show evidence of a later redactor because they're editorial, or parenthetical in nature, and they refer to a later time when Israel was in the land of their possession. Now how can Israel be in the land of their possession in Deuteronomy, which was before they went in the land? So that sounds like a later redactor. Three, the arrangement of Psalms into five books is undoubtedly the work of an editor. I mean, David didn't put it into five different books. David only wrote, what, about 72 of the Psalms himself. There are 150 of them. They were written by a whole bunch of people over a long period of time. So a later redactor had to obviously organize them. Four, Proverbs passed through the hands of editors after Solomon because it says in, for example, Proverbs 25:1, that these Proverbs were copied out by the men of Hezekiah. So long after Solomon died, people were copying out his Proverbs and redacting them, putting them into a book known as the present Book of Proverbs. Five, the book of books such as Jeremiah survive in two substantially different versions. The longer Masoretic version is 1/7 larger than the shorter Septuagint version, which survives in the Hebrew fragments from Qumran, which is 4Q Jeremiah B. The books of Chronicles present themselves as being based on prior prophetic records. All through the book of Chronicles, it'll say, as it is written in the book of, and they'll quote some book that's not in the Bible. So they were using records or documents. So these arguments, these six arguments are given in support of this redaction canon view, which is popularized by Emmanuel Tove. And they quote him, editor 2, Masoretic text, took the liberty of adding and changing many minor details and a few major ones. These changes are visible in 1, textual arrangement, 2, additions of headings to prophecies, 3, repetition of sections, 4, addition of new verses and sections, 5, addition of new details, and 6, changes in content. Now that means that the succeeding redactors, the so-called inspired redactors, which evangelicals are talking about, like Waalkey, made actual changes in the content, not just the form or arrangement, but in the content of what previous inspired authors said. So Moses wrote some inspired stuff. After him came some other redactor who changed the content of what Moses said, adding and subtracting things. Some redactional models have been proposed by evangelicals, including William Abram, Paul Archdemeyer, and Bruce Waalkey. Waalkey claims, quote, that the books of the Bible seem to have gone through an editorial revision after coming from the mouth of an inspired spokesman. In the same passage, he speaks of later editorial activity. Waalkey claims, we have evidence of redaction over at least 2 millennia, from 1800 BC to 200 BC. However, respondents to Waalkey's proposal, which he made at the ICBI conference, have rejected his position.